The following interview with Vic Fisher was conducted by Mike Malevsky on Thursday, February 20th, in the studios of Radio Free Palmer in downtown Palmer, Alaska. Enjoy. Well, folks, it's my great pleasure today to be here in the studio with Vic Fisher. I'm not going to try to give you a background introduction. His name is well known, and he is here in Palmer, Alaska today because he'll be speaking at the Palmer Rotary, and he'll also be doing a book signing at Farside Books. Vic, welcome.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be back at Palmer, one of my favorite places from 60-plus years ago.
Ah, okay. Do you remember the first time you were in Palmer, by any chance?
I don't remember exactly the first time, but I've been to and through Palmer over the decades many, many times.
Okay. Well, right now you're living in Anchorage.
Yes.
And you've been associated with, the list is almost endless. The Alaska Constitution.
Yes, I was a delegate to the convention.
Right. And you and Katie Hurley both were there. She had another role.
Katie was the chief clerk. She essentially ran the administrative end of the convention and made it click and made it work. And the delegate from Palmer was Jim Hurley.
Oh.
And Jim was a good friend, and Katie and Jim eventually married, and stayed married for many years, and Katie's going to be at the luncheon today.
That's right. She will. We'll look forward to that. So you say that there was a representative from Palmer. Maybe it would be worthwhile to share with people how you met up in Fairbanks. How were delegates selected? How was it that people were able to go?
This was in 1955.
Okay.
The convention was held, called by the legislature. It was held in Fairbanks to get it out of Juneau, where the environment was political and there were lobbyists and so on. And it was held in the middle of winter when it would be very, very cold, and lobbyists didn't show up, so it was pretty clean convention. Delegates were elected at three levels. There were seven elected for the territory of Alaska at large, trying to get more senior leaders who could keep regionalism and local issues out of it and sort of have a big high-level view. Then there were 30-some who were elected by the conventional major four judicial divisions of Alaska. They were at large within Southeast, South Central, Interior, and Western Arctic. And used to happen in territorial days, when the Congress specified that elections would be at large in four divisions, most of the people in South Central came from Anchorage. In Central, they came from Fairbanks, and so it was. And so the legislature provided not just the territory-wide, Alaska-wide delegates to the convention. They also provided for local delegates, and there were 15 districts from which local delegates were elected. So Palmer and Unalakleet and Kotzebue and Nome and Kodiak and Seward and Cordova and Valdez, right down to Ketchikan and Wrangell. There were local representatives. It was by far the most representative legislative body we ever had in Alaska.
Well, as you were talking, I was thinking back to the U.S. Constitution, and thinking of those many pictures that may give, you know, some insight into it. But it seemed as if representation for the U.S. Constitution was of a different sort.
It was by states.
Right.
And, of course, in those days, only men had the franchise to vote and to serve. So it was a different. very different character. And, of course, the U.S. Constitution was written in secret, and one of the early issues in the Constitutional Convention was whether committee meetings would be open to the public. And I was one of the advocates, together with John Helenthal, to make sure that the public had access to all the deliberations of the Constitutional Convention, and so it was.
Well, that's fascinating, given all of the questions and concerns that people have about transparency today, about backroom deals and things happening, et cetera. Now, we can fast forward, and we're looking very often back at that Constitution, which has set the tone for how Alaska has been. And I know that upcoming are a number of efforts to, in one way or another, extend that Constitution, revise it, maybe even change it significantly. On that particular topic, what you've been watching this over many years, decades, how would you place where we are today as different from other times in Alaska's history?
Well, during the writing the Constitution, people worked together. The writing of the Constitution took place before we became a state. It was part of our statehood movement to show the Congress and the nation that we Alaskans were mature enough to put together a modern Constitution based on traditional principles, and that we were ready to govern ourselves. Mm-hmm. And the statehood movement united the people of Alaska. It was overwhelmingly supported. It was not a Republican issue, a Democratic issue. It was an all-Alaska issue. And in the Constitutional Convention, there were no caucuses. There was no division according to party line. In fact, partisan politics was by rule kept out of the Constitutional Convention deliberations. Nobody talked about partisan politics, and it worked very effectively. People were really cooperative. We had a fabulous leader. Bill Egan was president of the Constitutional Convention, and every delegate from every place was equal and participated up to each individual's ability. But it was an Alaska United group that did it. Today, we seem to be divided on almost every issue that comes along. The parties are divided. There's reluctance to even talk to people who are sitting on the other side of the chamber, reluctance to debate issues, to compromise, to work out solutions where, it's a win-win situation rather than the minority gets rolled over. Mm-hmm. And this just shows up nationally, the inability of Congress and the president to come together and work things out. And it's a shame to have that in Alaska when we were united, regardless of whether we had Jay Hammond and Wally Hickel as Republican governors, or Bill Egan and Tony Knowles as Democratic governors. People did manage to work together in those days.
Well, that's fascinating because it suggests that, and as you were talking, I was thinking what you describe as a way to put the Constitution together, one would hope would be a similar environment in order to think about broader implications for any changes rather than target a particular purpose with a change that might be partisan in nature. So, of course, there's that other factor. Even in 1955, the population of Alaska was relatively small, certainly far smaller than it is today. And I'm wondering if maybe you would comment about that, that as the population has increased, as we have become a bit larger, how that has affected the Alaskan approach to doing things.
Well, I don't think it's so much the size of the population, but the concentration of population. There was a much more even distribution around Alaska, and now we have a concentration in the rail belt, you know, starting with Fairbanks and North Pole, and then coming down to Matsu Valley and the Anchorage municipality, and going down to including the Kenai Peninsula. So you have an overwhelming concentration. And rural areas in southeast have been minimized in terms of relative voting strength. And we have a U.S. constitutional issue of one person, one vote, so the rail belt has an overwhelming vote, and so the demography of Alaska has changed. Let me bring in one aspect when we look at the Constitution today.
Okay.
The convention provided within the Constitution that every 10 years Alaskans get to vote on shall there be a constitutional convention. And a constitutional convention can revise the whole Constitution. The people of Alaska have voted on that since statehood. And just last year in 2 years ago in 2012, the people of Alaska overwhelmingly said, no, we do not need to revise the Constitution. The other way of changing the Constitution is by amendment that is initiated in the legislature. It requires two-thirds vote of the House members and two-thirds vote of the Senate members to put an amendment before the people of Alaska, and then it's up to the people to approve or turn down the proposed amendment. And the Constitution has been amended a number of times, and there have been some good, from my standpoint, good constructive amendments. The Permanent Fund was set up by an amendment to the Constitution, which certainly has served Alaska well, saving some of our resource income for future generations. At the same time, it lends itself, the amendment process lends itself to political manipulation, and that's really what we're seeing in the legislature today, that there's an effort to revise basic principles of the Constitution. And it's really too bad, because it's a process that doesn't, in its deliberations, does not allow for people working together, compromising, and coming up with proper hearings and solutions. It becomes one group advocating and another group opposing, but not really deliberation.
Now, perhaps what we can do is also reflect upon another difference. You had the opportunity and did serve in the legislature, and over the years there have been varying different groups that have had an influence on the legislature, and the influence I'm speaking of is one where today we look at oil companies. And we say there's a lot of money that flows from oil companies, which it suggested as directed to influence what happens. As you think back over the years, would you say at this time we have an extraordinarily different situation with far more influence being exerted because of oil's prominent role in economy?
Well, this reminds me of the bumper sticker we had years ago, oil feeds my family. Mm-hmm. income from oil development certainly permeates Alaska's economy.
Okay, and, I support.
And is very critical to the function of state government, of the services and facilities we get. At the same time, the Constitution provides specifically that the legislature shall provide for development of resources for the maximum benefit of Alaska's people. Mm-hmm. And so it's always a question when we get into taxes and regulations and so on, what is maximum benefit to the Alaska's people while providing an adequate return to the oil producers to get them to produce an adequate amount of more oil or whatever the purpose may be, so that they have a maximum benefit and we have maximum benefit. And that is, of course, a very difficult line to draw. And we have an issue now where we've got a phenomenal amount of media advertising in behalf of the oil industry and having to do with oil taxes, where the major producers are investing millions of dollars to put their position before the Alaska public, before Alaska's future voters. So we have conflict resulting there, divisiveness, it's too bad that we can't really sit down and work things out, but we have the governor and the legislators who have a certain position, and then there are other people in Alaska, citizens, who don't agree with them, and they've started a referendum and will be voting on the oil tax issue in August. And again, this is in part a result that the two sides couldn't come together and reasonably come up with a solution that would be of maximum benefit to both parties.
Right. So you mentioned the fact again of the ballot, particularly the August primary ballot, as having an initiative, a referendum, and I just noticed that another choice has been added, that having to do with minimum wage. There's another vote that will be dealing with legalization of marijuana. What seemed to me, and maybe I've just been struck by the number of ballot questions that are going to be there, that this is another way in which that failure to come to solutions by working together has resulted in the population at large and some groups saying, okay, if you can't do it, then we're going to, or if you've acted in a way that we don't agree, we're going to put this out to everyone. What do you think about this process of referendum and initiatives?
The initiative and referendum were provided by the Constitutional Convention to give the people a chance to initiate laws or turn down laws enacted by the legislature, and it's part of letting the people participate in the process of running the state. I wasn't always very happy with the idea of our legislature and not being able to speak adequately in behalf of the people. But obviously, what we're seeing now is just some massive dissatisfaction with the way the legislature is and is not handling issues that are of concern to the people. So that's where we have these initiatives coming up in the referendum that we'll be voting on, some in the, most of them in the August primary. One of the aspects of what's going on in the legislature in this session is of particular concern to me. There are a number of proposed constitutional amendments before the legislature, and part of the legislative process increasingly has become log rolling, where at the end of a session, the powerful legislators hold up bills and they twist arms to get votes. And if you vote for me on this, I'll support you on that. And a number of basic principles of the Constitution could be totally undermined by some of the amendments pending before the legislature. And they have to do with public funds going for religious education and private educational institutions, with undermining the judicial system, where that has been exemplary in the whole United States of being non-politicized, being uncorrupted, very unlike other states that provide horrible examples of what can happen. And there are a few other amendments that are being discussed, and they're held up in committees, and anything can happen at the end of a legislative session. And it's sort of scary that the partisan political process may well put issues before the public without adequate discussion, without adequate consideration.
So the matter of climate change, politically, you've just been addressing in part what has happened over time. And of course, we have that broad other kind of climate change that is happening, which is Alaska's weather. I'm fascinated and really look forward to hearing from people who've been here for a while to say, you know, are things different today? Is the weather affecting us in a different way? And obviously we can look at things like the ice to the north and all the rest of that. What implications do you have for what appears to be significant change that makes Alaska different in the world?
Well, it's just fascinating sitting up here while the Arctic something or other is overwhelming the Midwestern states and the East Coast and the south of the United States with snowstorms and horrendous events while we bask in warm weather and worry about having enough snow for the Iditarod.
Right.
Sort of from a personal standpoint, I have always taken the weather as it comes. And I lived in Fairbanks for 10 years, working at the university up there. And I love the cold weather and the beautiful fall and so on. And you know, it'd go down to 50, 60 below, and that's pretty damn cold.
It is.
Living in Anchorage, things have never been quite as extreme as that. But I take things as they come. But in terms of tracking what's going on in the increasing view of the Arctic as a new transportation link between Europe and Asia and just across the Arctic and opening up resources that couldn't be even dreamed of being accessible before. There's obviously a tremendous change taking place. And, well, I'm not too deep into the science of it all. There's obviously big change going on, and just in terms of the emission of methane in the tundra and the Arctic generally, both on the Russian side and the Alaska side, there are big changes taking place. And, you know, I don't see bananas growing in the Matanuska Valley as part of the agriculture programs, but changes are taking place, and I won't live to see most of them, but my kids and grandkids certainly will.
Okay. Well, it would be wrong for me not to deal with one final issue here or question, and that is about the book, To Russia with Love. Whenever I have embarked on a long piece of writing, not ever as long as that book and all of its detail, I have felt changed by the process. What would you say changed as a result of your doing the book for you?
Well, I had a very long and interesting life. My father was an American born in Philadelphia. My mother was born in Tsarist Russia, so mm-hmm. I had a coming together of different backgrounds. I spent part of my childhood in Germany, part in Russia, served in the U.S. Army during World War II overseas, and I got an education thanks to the GI Bill of Rights, came mm-hmm. to Alaska, had a fabulous life in Alaska, and worked on Alaska-Russia programs when the Soviet Union fell apart. I mean, it's been a fabulous life. And as with the weather, I've sort of always done whatever was fascinating to me, and I lived with reality around me, worked as in positions where policy and planning, thinking about the future was important. But what the book did for me in delving into the past, going into records, reading my father's books and my mother's books and my brother's books, family correspondence going back 100 years, and having a most phenomenal co-writer, co-author, mm-hmm. Charles Woolforth, it's made me much more aware of myself. I had never been a very introspective person, sort of psychologically or in any other way. And Charles, as my partner in mm-hmm. doing the book, kept asking me, well, how did you feel about that? How okay. do you feel about it today, looking back on what transpired 40 or 60 years ago? And I have thought during the process of writing the book and probably during the year or two since then, I've thought much more about the meaning of life, my parents' roles in my development, the environment in which I grew up, and sort of about philosophical issues of what's happening around me in Alaska today.
Whew, huge impact. Thank you, Vic Fisher, for coming in today, talking a little bit about Alaska over the years.
Mike, and thank you for the public service of helping run this phenomenal radio station.
Thank you, sir.